And this was a damn good episode. I thoroughly enjoyed this episode. This episode is with Dr. Max Felker Cantor. We came across Professor Cantor's work through friend of show, friend in real life, Toure Reed. He sent us an article that Max wrote in the Washington Post about how municipal politics insulate law enforcement from any sort of dealing with any sort of real punishment, right? Any sort of oversight. And I am a fan of Mike Davis's work. I came across his work late in life, I'm not going to lie, and act like I was reading City of Quartz in the mid to late 90s when he came out. I was not doing that, especially at that point in my life. But Max's work did remind me a lot of Davis's work. He said he actually went back to study some of Davis's stuff for his book about race, politics, and Los Angeles Police Department. And we had a long talk about this, about the patronage politics of the black politics. Max also wrote a great piece in the Washington Post, the LA Times or Washington Post. I will link the pieces in the description where you're listening to this show about how the 1984 Olympics was a precursor to arming the Los Angeles Police Department with the military-grade weapons that they got and helping increase the police budget. So I was excited for this show. Pascal was excited for the show, and it was a good show, an even better bonus half because we had the calls. The calls are always an adventure, if you will, because we're still figuring out the whole call-in game. Look, I sprung it on Pascal. He did not want to do calls at all. And once I said calls, Jean Bajelan chuckled and Pascal Robert grimaced. But for the most part, the call session has been fine. There's someone that I think trolls the calls and plays a recording of something. We can't hear it. We can't understand it. So we just kind of sit there like, what? Other than that, they've been great. And we had some really good calls on this show. But the calls are only in the bonus patron half. So if you want to call in, be a part of the show, yell at us, tell us what you disagree with. Give us your take on a situation. It's easy. Become a patron. Wherever you're listening to the show. There are links to the description. They'll take you right to Patreon. It is patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. Also, if you want to watch the show in real time, every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific time and Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific time. It's simple. We stream on all social media, Twitch, Facebook, Twitter, but most people are on YouTube. So it's youtube.com/thisisrevolutionpodcast. We are finding, I went and looked at some of the numbers on YouTube, that little less than half of the views that we get are from non-subscribers. What? Subscribe, just click the bell. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. We'd appreciate the support. But in this episode, I made a video of about a case that doesn't get a lot of publicity. No one really talks about it. And this is before Rodney King. This is in 1979. A woman named Eula Love was gunned down by L.A. police. And in making the video for the show, I've been making these. So I'll try to be as brief as possible. We agreed to do a video essay series for Zero Books. It's called The Dispatch. There's also links to The Dispatch in the description. And the first one was an essay I wrote, and I put the images together, and it's difficult for me. I did not know I was going to be doing video when I started doing this podcast, right? I thought I'd do this for 5 seconds, go on tour, and then do it again when I got back. I didn't know that this was going to be what I do, and creating video is one of the things now that I do. So I've been making these intro videos for the show. And in making this intro video, I kind of started finding footage, archival footage of like town hall meetings of this Eula Love killing, which is really horrible. Eula Love is a woman. I'll be very brief. I talk about it again on the show. I'll just try to be as brief as possible. A woman who was widowed. Her husband died of sickle cell about 6 months after her husband passed. She has like 3 daughters to take care of. She's late on a electric bill. Power company bill. So back in the day, I think they still do it now. The power company sent someone to collect, and they're like, look, if you don't have the cash, we're just going to shut this shit off. We're not taking your check. We're going to shut this shit off. She got into it with them. She goes to a check cashing place to cash a check to give them the money, and she can't have her power shut off. They get frustrated with her, and they call police. She comes home to see another person there with police. She gets mad. They're charging more fees. She goes in the house in frustration, comes out with a butcher knife. The police unload. 2 cops unload into her, kill her instantly. 12 holes in that woman. Horrible. Horrible. Nothing happens to the police. District attorneys decide not to prosecute. The mayor's hands are tied because of the municipal politics of the police force in Los Angeles that kept people like Daryl Gates in power for so long. This is what we're going to talk about on this episode with Dr. Max Felker-Cantor, professor at Ball State University. And I am out. Thank you. Hello. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Welcome to This is Revolution. I get excited every time that song comes on, and it makes me want to play live again. Not going to happen anytime soon, but it will happen again. I don't know. Working on that. Actually, we're going to start talking to the band again about doing some live streaming stuff. But anyway, let me introduce my co-host, my homie, my dog. You may know him from the plethora of panels he is invited to. He has published recently a piece in Black Agenda Report, which got picked up by another organization. I can't remember. He's just too popular. Pretty soon he's going to leave me, as I am nothing but a stepping stone.
My homie, my dog, my partner in crime and slime, Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Brother, I'm not going to leave you, brother. I want to bring you along. We're going to take it as high as we can, brother. Take it as high as we can.
When you said that, all of a sudden, 80s Steve Winwood is in my head.
I love Steve Winwood. I love Steve Winwood.
You made Steve Winwood just go. You people are so lucky that I will not pay to license any music. Because if so, you'd be hearing a lot of Steve Winwood and Michael McDonald. Anyway, today we are going to be talking about police violence and municipal politics that insulate police forces. And it's something, you know, you hear defund the police quite often. And in cities like LA, it's a little more complicated, right? So we knew this show was coming up, and our guest, Dr. Max Felker-Cantor, wrote a couple really good articles that I've been kind of reading over and over and over again, taking notes, and it sent me down a rabbit hole to try to find some good footage. So before we bring our guest on, let's play. Give me 1 second here. Let's play the intro video.
Which was it? Excessive use of force by Los Angeles police or understandable reaction in self-defense? The answers involve larger questions about police practices, news organizations, and the responsibility of citizens. Terry Drinkwater reports.
Eula Love was a 39-year-old widow who was gunned down by LAPD in 1979. After the death of Love's husband from sickle cell anemia 6 months earlier, it became hard for her to make ends meet and support their 3 daughters. On the day of the shooting, Love had an altercation with the representative from the gas company that was sent to her home to collect an overdue bill. After Love went to a store to cash a check to pay the bill, Love got home to find another person from the gas company who had called the police on her. Frustrated, Love went in her home and came out with a butcher knife. The police shot her 12 times, killing her instantly.
The American Civil Liberties Union says that in the last 4 years, officers here have shot over 300 people, killing nearly half of them.
We're no longer going to stand aside and let the police department shoot our people down in cold-blooded murder.
But the district attorney investigated the Eula Love shooting and decided not to prosecute the officers, calling their actions justifiable homicide in their own self-defense. Police Chief Daryl Gates.
I think it's about time that we say something about the responsibility of people in this community not to solve their problems with violence, because violence begets violence. And that's what Eula Love did on this occasion.
But Mayor...
The fight against police violence has become a central part of the political discourse in contemporary America post-George Floyd. The slogan, Defund the Police, came about in the wake of that George Floyd moment. Remedies from police cameras, challenging police unions, and tampering down the use of the police officer's Bill of Rights have been suggested to cut down on the numbers of police killings of unarmed civilians. But there are institutional mechanisms that entrench police representation in the upper echelons of municipal governments that also have a strong role in providing cover for police when they abuse their power and cause harm to civilians. In this episode, we will ask, how does municipal politics help shield police from accountability? This is Revolution.
Mayor Bradley's police commission concluded just the opposite, saying the officers were premature in drawing their weapons. Chief Gates says that finding devastated morale in his department. And in defense of his men, the chief has gone on the attack, suggesting there's a conspiracy against those who uphold law and order. In a closed-circuit TV address to the department, he placed the blame generally on the media.
We don't know the problem because we know what that all that's going to mean. You would just need somebody else to rubber stamp and stuff. We don't need this guy. We ain't down here talking about no high positions and stuff like that. The people are going to get justice, and it's going to be in the street.
The police cannot police themselves, nor can the district attorney's office, who works daily hand in hand with the Los Angeles Police Department, prosecuting citizens for alleged misconduct, then changes hats and becomes the investigator and prosecutor of the police accused of misconduct, sometimes by the same citizens themselves. Thirdly, this police commission, this citizens' police commission, I don't believe it can do the job.
Yes, sir. Completely structured cage, bars, another buzz door to get in over this place. When we went in, there was a gun next to the teller window, which is what I describe it as, because it reminded me of a bank. You know, you buy your thing into a tray, and you get your drugs out through the tray. But it was quite a...
What are these neighbors? They must feel glad to see this.
Most of them are, yeah. They're the ones that call and complain.
Are they?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, they call back later and say, after the day after the investigation, I had a number of calls saying, good job, you did a great job, you know. And as a matter of fact, the guy that's really supplying the place, this is the information about the element. So there is a lot of cooperation.
Yeah. He's their neighbor, a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
Sad.
You know, kids, I see the kids going by every day, and the kids see it. They want something done.
Yeah.
Let us know. Then we have to be more careful because we can't let anybody know. Otherwise, their life.
Plus, the message that people that run this place are making is that, you know, we know you know we're here, but you can't get in to get us. You know, and that just is unacceptable.
Yeah.
As far as
I'm concerned. Yeah.
Vice President, tell us, having looked at this, seeing what the local police did, what can a president do about this?
Well, I'm going to be speaking about that in a little bit and later on, too. Some very good ideas today from a lot of the people that are out on the front lines in this fight.
How does this tour, though, influence your ideas?
Well, it influences my ideas because I'm talking to people that are actually out there waging the battle. And you learn from it. And it brings it home dramatically. Whether it's the chief of police or whether it's a guy out here making this kind of a bust and break-in, physically coming in to relieve a neighborhood of this kind of filth. I mean, can't help but feel that way. Anybody that has practical experience, you learn more from that. And it's not show business. It's trying to learn and understand and then take action. And that's what I want to do if I'm elected, and this is extraordinarily helpful to me.
That I'm not sure we were heard on, and I want to make this clear, but it is our point that there's no reason for the police department to be fearful of input from our community. That alone shows a lack of a proper understanding of the role our community should play in the policing of our community.
All right. Well, thank you guys for checking out that clip. And let's bring in our guest, Dr. Max Felker-Cantor. He is the author of Policing Los Angeles, Race, Resistance, and the Rise of LAPD. He is an American historian who specializes in 20th century American and African American history with a focus on race, policing, and social movements. Without any further ado, thank you for your patience, Max. Max Felker-Cantor!
All the sound effects. Thank you.
I do have a board.
Thank you for having me.
We tried.
Wasn't ready for that one.
I sent out your article today on Twitter, and I said, homework for today's show, everybody. And so one of the people in the chat just said, I actually did the reading for today. It was great.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you for reading it. Now, if more people would just go buy the book.
I will put a buy link up for the book. And I actually put your in the link for the description of wherever you're watching the show is Max's website. So you can get it from his website as well. There's a link in the website as well, I believe.
Max, I had prepared a list of questions for you, but in listening to your bio and your background, I want to pitch a question to you that's a bit of a curveball.
Sure, sure.
I think you have the credentials to answer this question, and I'd like to hear your input. There is a debate in segments, particularly intellectual segments of the Black community, on the origin of policing. Mm-hmm. There are some who believe that the origin of policing goes back to slave patrols. As a matter of fact, there's a new book out right now that is pushing the argument that the Second Amendment was drafted in the Constitution in order to weaponize white citizenry in order to help with slave patrols. Yep. And I know even certain black academics find that that's a very myopic narrative of how the Second Amendment came about. A lot of it had to do with fear of Native Americans, fear of the French, so on and so forth. You don't have to go into that, but can you address the veracity or lack thereof of the police started with slaves patrol theory? Mm-hmm. Or there's also the theory that police are a product of the rise of the urban environment, particularly in the Northeast, Boston, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Right. Can you give us your academic specialties answer to that question, please?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, I am someone who would say that actually the police, you know, policing and the police, you know, the history of policing is rooted in the slave patrol and anti-blackness. Carol Anderson's new book that I think you're referring to about the Second Amendment, right? She tracks that kind of the ways that gun rights and Second Amendment is really is rooted in anti-blackness as well. But I would also say that actually policing has kind of three elements to its history and where we can see it founding. Yes, it's about urban Northeast, Midwest, Chicago, right? And it was really there to control working classes, right? So you have a class element, and its policing comes about in a form of settler colonialism too, right? As you mentioned. So I would say that policing in those three areas, but especially in the slave patrol that then morphs into essentially white mobs being empowered to police through the, you know, 19th century. And then the formalization of departments is rooted in that kind of founding moment of policing, you know, in anti-blackness in this country. And so we have to understand policing rooted in those kind of fundamental moments in American history that are about racism, settler colonialism.
Well, the one thing that's important is that either way, whether you're talking about slave patrols or you're talking about the rising of the urban centers, policing is used as a social control mechanism to control workers.
Yes, period. It's about controlling work or eliminating native peoples from land, right? Exactly. Indigenous peoples, yeah.
Someone asked a question. Are there policing antecedents outside the United States, in Europe, and in other parts of the world? Or is this a phenomenon that starts in the United States?
Well, I mean, you have policing in places around the world, right? You know, I mean, the kind of traditional narrative, right, is the London Metropolitan Police create the kind of first formal police department. But you see, you know, if you go back even further, if we look at policing as kind of a form of control, we see it in European colonialism and expansion, right? You could go much further back, and that there are models, and that some of the early models, if we look at like the night watch or the constabulary, you know, in northeastern cities, that's rooted in European ideas, right? And that what people brought over, which was also rooted in particular forms of social control, especially around work and class and labor, right? That you're referring to.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, well now we'll go.
So those are great questions. I mean, we could talk about that too.
I didn't mean to throw you a curveball. You know, I just felt that, you know, you're particularly qualified. Okay, Max, can you explain for our audience how municipal hierarchies, especially through city managers, can create vehicles that protect police from investigations in cases of unjustified civilian abuse?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a great question. I mean, this goes back to, you know, this piece that I wrote, which was really about the city manager position in Brooklyn Center, right, with the killing of Dante Wright, and this kind of moment that was really struck me because it I mean, historically, I'll talk about this later, I think, when we get to it, is that there was this moment where they're like, the mayor of the city wanted to fire the police officer who killed Dante Wright, and they didn't have the power to do it because the structure of that city was set up in which the city council, which is elected, appointed a city manager. So you're getting this kind of hierarchy within the city just from that kind of structure of the city. And, you know, there's some evidence that says that like over 55% of cities are structured this way now. It's becoming really this kind of major way that cities get structured. And what it does is it puts this supposedly professional city manager in charge to manage to basically administer the city on a day-to-day basis with particular authority and power. And in some cases, they have the power to fire, you know, they are the ones who are able to fire officers. It's not with the elected city council. And so what you've started to see is, in at least in that case, in that hierarchy, is you're starting to get though, is the bureaucracy actually creates insulation to policing and to police departments and to police officers. This is not to say anything about the ways that there's all other layers of the way the police have kind of insulated themselves. And I know we're going to get to this, I think, probably later around unions or, you know, police officer bill of rights or all those other things. But the, just in the kind of structure of those cities, the police get insulated from direct oversight from the people who are elect, who people elect to be the city council members in many ways. And so that creates this kind of, we don't think about it. It's kind of unforeseen. And that was kind of the point that I was trying to get at with that piece, is to say, look, there's this ways that even within just how we have cities designed, even in some cases where, you know, and I can talk about Los Angeles, where the mayor has certain powers, they have a mayor and city council structure, but the mayor appoints a board of police commissioners that then oversees the department. And so you can start just to see that just in how cities set up and the power, the way that power operates in cities by usually the municipal charter starts to create these kind of, you know, a situation in which the police then can are not directly accountable to the people that elected them, let alone, you know, the city councilors or even the mayors in some cases, because they've been kind of, whether we call it intentional or unintentional, it's this kind of insulating or buffering from of the police from, you know, being able to be directly accountable to those people that elected them. So that's, you know, in some ways the answer that, you know, to address that question. I'm sure you have follow-ups.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more, kind of take a deeper dive in this with LA as a great example.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Daryl Gates.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who for years gave his force these 5-star reviews. Mm-hmm. And you write actually very, very, I love the fact that you took it all the way back to 1889 to talk about how the police have insulated themselves from any sort of citizen control. And that clip that you guys watch from the 1979 Eula Love case, which is one that rarely do you hear people talk about. At this point, you rarely hear people talk about even Rodney King. But there was a lot of the footage that I captured, and I was telling Max earlier that if I would have had my choice, that would have been about a 30-minute little montage thing there. And there were people fighting for, and one of the things that I saw in a lot of these city council hearings, and what you saw towards the end of it, you saw this black gentleman with I think it was a white guy. They were part of the Communist Party, and they were calling for community oversight over law enforcement. And even Mayor Tom Bradley was pretty much impotent when it came to being able to fight Daryl Gates, and he gave no fucks and punked the city council quite often. And if you I don't know if people could even see, that was George Bush Senior on the campaign trail with Daryl Gates, and this is of course, you know, right before the Rodney King beating, when they go to that crack house. So if you want to just kind of expand on LA.
Totally. The LA story, you know, is one that I think really, you know, is instructive. Obviously, it's what I study, but, you know, so going back, if we go way back, you know, to that late 19th century, what I said, 1889, you know, is in between that period, the 1890s and into the 1920s, even into the 1930s in some cases, there's the police are corrupt, right? That's basically what all these urban, you know, these cities are all saying. It's like the police, the problem of police brutality, of police violence, you know, is that they are in the pockets of politicians, you know, is that city, you know, this goes back to even New York and Tammany Hall and all these other places, is that they're like, you know, and so you have progressive era reformers, this kind of moment in U.S. history where they're like, we're going to clean up City Hall, we're going to make, you know, professionalize things. And what starts to happen in Los Angeles is that they were like, you know, the police are just, every new politician just fires officers at will. fires the police chief, you know, and just brings in new people. And so what these reformers started to do, and the police departments, you know, in some cases, you know, they're positioning themselves in this as well. They start to pass reforms to the city charter in LA. And what that does, they pass reforms that do things like, we're going to divorce the police. The police need to be, you know, divorced from direct political oversight or patronage. And so they're like, well, we're going to give the chief of police civil service protection, which will come back to the Gates point that you just made. So they have civil service protection, which means, well, you can't just fire them, right? Unless you have cause, because they're protected. The chief of police also, we're going to get discipline for everyday, you know, for beat officers. The discipline is going to be the chief of police gets that power, no one else. The accountability is then internal. And there's actually a city charter which says, you know, all disciplinary powers end with the police of chief of police.
Insane.
And so, yeah, you get this, and this is an, and this is all, you know, these are all quote well intended, right? To say like, okay, we're going to give essentially the police chief life tenure, right? Because that civil service protection, and there's no term limits. And so that's why when we get to it, between 1950 and 1992, you effectively have three police chiefs in Los Angeles. There's another one in there that's there for about 2 years, but otherwise you have William Parker from 50 to 1966.
The guy that started the whole thing, right?
What's that?
The guy that started the whole
thing. Yeah. So I can talk a little bit about him next but you know, and so what you get in this city charter reform to kind of come back to that is, hey, police chiefs, you can't always be fired. You know, you've got your civil service protected. You know, we're going to make sure that the new mayor who comes in isn't just going to fire you. So you can create a kind of better department that's not corrupt, right? And get those politicians, get the officers, you know, no more graft, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Parker comes in and he takes that foundation and is like, essentially is like, hey, you know, I'm going to take this and run with it. And then under the guise of what he calls professionalization, meaning like better standards, better disciplinary practices, he further insulates the police department from even what little oversight the mayor and the city have. And so the mayor appointed a board of police commissioners that then would appoint the police chief. But essentially, they didn't have any power over discipline, or they couldn't fire the police chief, right, unless they had cause. And so Parker takes that and is like, hey, we're going to create an internal affairs division. There weren't always internal affairs. He says, we're going to actually create, we'll police ourselves effectively, right? And so they get
a blue ribbon committee.
Right. And so it's like, hey, well, if we have an internal affairs, well, we're professionals, right? We're just like other professions, and we should assess ourselves, right? That, you know, that's where you get these intern. And so Parker creates those division within the department to say, we're going to do that. We're going to raise standards, raise, you know, the pay, all those things. But essentially Parker further pushed and took that structure that was created and said, we can really empower ourselves as the police within this structure, especially around discipline, right? And so, you know, and then, so this, and Parker's there for over 15 years. He dies in 66, right after the Watts uprising. And so what you start to see then, you know, when we get to Gates, when you see that the way that this works is, so Daryl Gates was in that video, as you mentioned, they wrote their own self-reports every year. So the police chief wrote the self-evaluation of the police department. And so there was never any cause that anyone could point to say, well, we have reasons to fire you.
Yeah.
And so, and the year before the police beat up Rodney King, mm-hmm. Gates rates his department excellent in everything, including things like police community relations and mm-hmm. community, you know, engagement sorts of things, right? And this is a year after, you know, it's right in the middle of the war on drugs and the war on gangs, which is what the clip you showed with H.W. Bush, right? He was there at a what they would have called a, you know, crack house yeah. and saying, oh, look at the militarized drug gangs. We need to root them out. And so that's, you know, and so they were, the police there, right, were positioning themselves again, right, politically, because they were shaping the narrative around drugs and gangs and getting politicians on their side. But that's a whole other story too. And so Gates is, you know, giving all the, and so he's there for 14 years. And so it's kind of a, you know, we can start to see the ways that the, all of these reforms then insulate the police to, into which they're almost unaccountable to anyone when you have these instances of police violence. The one time that you see this start to change in LA is after 92, the 92 rebellion, right? Is that, or following Rod, the beating of Rodney King and the 92 rebellion, the people in LA put on a, up for a vote, a city charter amendment. So after, you know, 80 years of a city charter structure, they then say, we're going to pass a charter amendment to change the city structure so that the police chief can only serve 2 5-year terms and have to be reappointed after the first 5-year term. So there's some sort of changes there, but it's, you know, you can see this kind of long history, the way LA and Daryl Gates and these, you know, they're in there for forever in many ways.
And Daryl Gates, you know, so you have Eula Love, which I believe happens under Daryl Gates in his career. And then after that, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, was Mark something. And he died of the carotid choke, which was kind of the standard policy in Los Angeles. And the story is the gentleman was, this is about 82. Mm-hmm. The gentleman is coming home and he gets stopped for a cracked windshield by police. He gets a ticket. He drives off, still headed home, and he gets pulled over by the police again. Same thing. Then he runs off. He's like, fuck it. And he tries to get home fast, doesn't get home fast enough. The police come to his house. The scuffle starts, and they put him in carotid, with their excuse being that he is on PCP. Mm-hmm. That kind of becomes the excuse du jour to beat the shit out of people, which is, well, these people act differently when they're on PCP. You can't just knock them out. You can't just control them. So we put them in a carotid chokehold. And when Daryl Gates was, you know, the same thing happens, right? You get a community panel. Everybody says, hey, what the hell's going on? Motherfuckers got to stop beating the shit out of us and killing us. And he wasn't the first guy to die. There was quite a few people that were dying in these carotid chokeholds, and they happened to be black, right? So Daryl Gates is like, these colored boys just have different necks.
Yep. Yeah, no, they, Gates, I mean, the, within about 4 years, 16 people in LA die, 12 of them black, by the chokehold, you know, and so it's, and Gates has that famous line that you mentioned, that the that they seem to find, quoting, you know, that the veins in black people are not opening up as fast as in, quote, normal people, right? And it's this whole thing. And you would think that that would lead, you know, there's massive outcry from the activist community, and from politicians, you know, and city, you know, people who are calling him out, but there's no real recourse. It's kind of just, it moves ahead. And from 82 then on, and there's some sort of moratoriums on the chokehold and things. Right. But, you know, and then they use it as an excuse because they're like, well, if you didn't let it, we couldn't use the chokehold on Rodney King. So we just beat him with tasers and batons. Right.
And they complain about it. If you've seen interviews with the officers after the beat, they're like, you know, if they just would let us use a chokehold, we wouldn't have had to beat shit out of them with them motherfucking batons. That's y'all fault.
Right. So, yeah. And so, but so Gates goes, he goes through the Love case, the chokehold cases, Operation Hammer, right, which is notorious for, you know, mass sweeps of African Americans, and under drugs and gangs. And then he also, there's a moment in which in 1989, the police attack this apartment building at 41st and Dalton, in which, you know, under the guise of it's the war on drugs and gangs, they planned it for months. They brought in all these, like, you know, experts and, you know, to kind of analyze, you know, kind of this interagency type of task force, that bringing in their drug, you know, the elite drug and gang units to do so. And then what they do is they ransack this apartment. Essentially, the police were the gangs. They came in and destroyed an apartment building, found no gang members, found almost, you know, a little bit of marijuana, you know, almost no drugs.
Yeah.
And the apartment was so uninhabitable that the Red Cross had to provide emergency housing for some of the, you know, and so this is all leading up to that Rodney King moment.
I was initially looking for that footage, which sent me down the Eula Love rabbit hole, which is actually kind of funny that we actually bring this up.
Yeah. And so, but it's just to show all of those things could happen. And Gates is still like, well, there's nothing you can, he's still there and he's still in power. Yeah. Even if Bradley was calling for, you know, pushing, you know, Mayor Tom Bradley, you know, the African-American mayor who's in power for 20 years himself. Right.
That's a whole other show that we talked about.
A whole other thing. and so it just, but it gets to show, you know, and Gates, again, this is maybe a slightly different rabbit hole, always used the claim of this was an aberration.
Yes.
Right. These are bad apples. Or in the case of the war on drug, you know, the Operation Hammer and gang sweeps and drug sweeps and the Dalton Street raid, you know, quite explicitly, he's like, we're going to wage a war on the streets of LA. You know, he's like, we are going to go out and beat heads, basically.
And that's another thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I'll be real quick about it. I know you're a little younger than us. I don't know if you've seen the movie Colors, and I'll put this out to the chat as well. You know, chat, I'm sure you guys have seen the movie Colors. If you watch the movie Colors, which is about the crash unit, which is PD, LAPD, and the Sheriff's Department. If you watch the movie Colors, they are just outgunned by this technologically advanced, well-armed street gangs. And they have this, you know, super high-tech drug operation that the LAPD just can't get their head around.
Right.
And what's funny about that, there's a scene in that movie where they bust in someone's house and they have just shotguns and a crowbar. And that happens literally the same year you're describing that raid on that house where they come through with that tank-like fucking machine.
Oh, yeah, that's a different part. That's a whole other, yeah.
They were given all this military-grade weaponry. Mm-hmm. They were actually the militarizing force in Los Angeles at the time. They were their own gang, if you will. And that movie paints such a different picture of this outgunned, outmanned police force in general that I think a lot of people don't really understand exactly how violent the LAPD was at that time.
Right. Well, I think it just goes to, you know, again, we have to, Gates, you know, and I think in the video even that you were showing, talks about how, oh, the Eula Love case in that clip you were showing, right, saying, well, violence begets violence, and Eula Love was the violent one, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing that is like, well, the police were, you know, really the purveyors of violence in the city, you know, and so especially when it comes to, you know, whether we talk about the use of that 14-foot batter ram on a tank-like vehicle, and all of the, you know, that was used to smash into a house, and they found a mom with her kids eating ice cream, or, you know, all that, those stories. And it's like, well, they were, you know, but this is where, to the point about Colors and other media, is that the police craft that narrative, right, of themselves as being, we're the outgunned, we're the ones who are on the defensive. We need, you know, we need more, essentially, is what they're saying. We need more funding. We need, you know, more military weapons. We need more, you know, public support. And so they kind of frame themselves that way, right? And you can see it, you know, even in Hollywood constructions, right? And so those are...
Yeah, especially that era. Pascal, I know you have more questions.
Sure, Max. So I want to ask you, since you went through this history, do you think attempting to challenge the police officer's Bill of Rights and the use of force matrix are futile police reforms if we don't tackle the way the municipal political hierarchy allows police misconduct to occur?
No,
in other words, is this a necessary part of what a police reform has to be?
Well, I think I think that they're not futile. I think, I mean, I would, we could talk, we could, you know, have a whole other discussion about use of force matrix and whether that reform is really a move towards, you know, really actually addressing the power the police have. Police officers' Bill of Rights are really important to address as well. I don't know if they're futile. I think what we have to, what the point about municipal hierarchies and power structures and bureaucracies of cities is to say that there are these other really mundane, and some people might say like boring as shit things, right, in city politics that that people aren't aware of. They're, it's very easy to point to like, hey, we need to get rid of that police officer's Bill of Rights. And, you know, we do. But then there's these other elements where you might say, well, if we really want to address the structure of city, of power in the city, we may have to start looking at city charters and who has the power to hire and fire officers, right? Do they, you know, and so I think there's an element of that that we have to kind of be, do need to be aware of to move in directions that get, that reduce the power, you know, of police in our cities and communities. And so, so there is that element of it. I don't know if it's, if those other ones are futile without it. It sort of depends, I would argue, I guess I would say, on the specific local nature of the city power structure, right? If there's something in the city charter, like LA's historically, which was like, hey, police chief, you can stay in for as long as you want, changing the use of force matrix isn't going to do much, right? Because in LA, they changed the use of force policy numerous times in the 70s and 80s after police killings, usually of Black or Latinx, you know, members of the community. And that what ends up happening then is they just say, okay, well, the Board of Police Commissioners has developed a new use of force policy. Things like that you can't shoot someone who's fleeing from you. You can't, you know, you have to use reverence for human life, all those sorts of things. And so in that case where the police department is insulated, maybe, yes, I would argue there's a way that without those other changes in the city, those things won't do much. But I think, you know, so depending, it sort of depends on that nature. If the police are structured in that way, you know, and all cities are different in the kind of details of those, it's kind of a middle of the road answer, but.
No, it's a decent answer. So let me ask you another question, a follow-up question. Do you know of any cities that are currently going about police reform that have a paradigm that you can see are replicable that you would say, well, this is a good example of something I'd like to see, you know, transplanted throughout the country?
Right. No, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think after the past, you know, after last year, you know, I think there is, you know, I think the moves that Minneapolis was making, right, the big moves towards sort of thinking about retooling the entire department, obviously that didn't get developed, you know, or didn't play out, right, because they didn't actually put that on the table. But what you say, I think the cities that have started to say things like, we are going to start actually defunding the police and rethinking what we what police ask. So I wouldn't say there's any one, but if you look at places around the country, so like some places, I think Denver and places have taken police out of schools. You know, you've got some places where they've reduced the police budget. You've got other places where, you know, they've started to say, we're going to, you know, and I'm thinking it's Seattle, but I could be wrong off the top of my head, right, of the ways that the police, you know, they're going to say, we're not going to use the police for calls that don't require any force, right? And so we're going to have other institutions in the city do that, whether it's, you know, responding to mental health calls or to domestic disputes and all of that. And so, so there are kind of an amalgamation of those types of reforms that I think we see in different places, that are all moving, in a way, because when I think about reforms that are moving us in a good direction are ones that don't empower the police more. And so those are, you can think of those as all ones, whether that's defunding, whether that's taking police out of places that they weren't before, right? There weren't police in schools, you know, prior to the, really in any dramatic way prior to the 1970s. There were in some cases in the 40s and 50s, but and 60s, but it really blows up in the 70s and 80s. So it's like, let's take police out of those places. Why do they need to be in these, in every institution and every part of social life where they hadn't been before? So you're moving in that direction. And then, you know, that so we want to move in that direction. And what I mean by other types of reform, things that many times we think of as reform, are actually empowering the police. So like sometimes when we say, oh, we'll give them body cameras, all that's doing in many cases is giving more money and funding to the police. And and as well as things like, oh, well, let's fund community policing. It's funneling more money into these institutions, which are really resistant to change.
Do you think that defund the police is actually an effective slogan or so quote unquote movement in terms of dealing with police reform? Or don't you think it kind of sets up this kind of canard that when you say defund the police, you're saying that you want to abolish the police, which may not be a problem depending on your politics.
Depending on who you are, yeah.
Or depending on who you are. Because one of the arguments that Jason makes, which is a very good one, is that when you say defund the police, you're not ending policing, because people will be policed. The question is, are you going to have a social worker acting like a cop when she's called to handle a person who is in a crisis situation as opposed to just a cop? I'd like us to really kind of get through the weeds on this defund the police slogan and what it means.
Yeah, Jason's ready.
this is my whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean the line that, you know, many of us, you know, we think about it is like, well, defund and invest, right? So defund from certain institutions, invest in others. Now, the question of whether you're just then funding other institutions that are going to start acting like police, you know, the question, I think, comes down to the use of violence and the use of force. Is, you know, the police see themselves, the police are violent, right? The police are at the center, you know, are inherently violent, right? That's what they have been set up to do. And so the question is, if you open up new types of, you know, if you empower, as the example, Pascal, that you were saying, you know, social workers to respond to certain, the question becomes then also, are you using force? What does that look like? You know, and so, because are they just going to replicate policing in another form? That's where we get to, do you need to just totally blow the whole thing up and rethink how we think about community safety, right? And how people's needs are met. And that's like a discussion of, well, you know, do communities police themselves? How do they do that? What does that look like? That's what activists in LA were talking about in the 1970s and 80s. They were saying, you know, we want community control over the police, which was not just like, we want to be able to oversee them. They were essentially saying, we want decision-making power about how the police work in our communities. And that was what Kappa and these other, and some of the other groups were getting at. And so, you know, defunding gets into this kind of, hey, we're just going to, you know, it's depending on who you are, you know, it leads towards abolition, I think, but it also leads people to think about, well, you're just going to take money away from police, then what's going to happen, right? But you have to have these other solutions that go with it. And, you know, I'd be interested in, Jason, what you think, you know, about this. Because the idea that social workers might become cops is, I think, one we have to be really wary of.
And right? No one talks about that. And that's my problem. And I'll bring it back to Eula Love. And this is why Eula Love really, and I heard it before I did the research, really sticks to me. When you think about the fact that a woman who is newly widowed, let's just take the widow part out of the equation.
Yeah.
We have a poor person that can't afford to pay a bill. Mm-hmm. And the city is cracking down. And I don't know if anybody here in the chat has ever dealt with a bill collector. I'll be honest, I'm pretty fucking broke. And I had a motherfucker call me not too long before I got on this show. And Pascal can tell you, I was a little irritable because they're not polite. Mm-hmm. They talk down to you, right? So imagine someone not just called you on the phone, but is at your house about to cut off your shit. And they don't like dealing with you. And what's the first thing they do? They fucking call law enforcement. They call law enforcement. Even if a social worker showed up to calm that woman down, there's a fundamental problem here with the way we're dealing with poverty,
mm-hmm.
period, point blank. And if we want to talk about invest in, I love that slogan so much more. Because now we're talking about keeping Eula Love from having her power cut off. We're not talking about her power being cut off. We're talking about how humanely you can cut her power off. We're going to cut your power off with a smile. We're going to cut your power off with a mental health professional that's going to talk you down and make you feel a lot better about the fact that your black ass is going to be in the dark tonight. I don't really like that.
Right. No, and that gets us to where the police, you know, I mean, the whole structure is set up to support private property and profit, right? Which is what we could, the whole other, you know, thing that we need to, you know, about, you know, that police are there to support capital, right? Mm-hmm. As well, right? Especially, you know, LA, you know, in that moment in LA, you're going through a moment in the late 70s, but also in the early 80s, in which tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs leave the city, and the poverty rates, especially in, you know, Black and Latinx communities, but the Black community in particular in LA is skyrocketing, right? And so you have like 40% unemployment in particular, you know, age groups. And so you get this total devastation while then Bradley and others are investing boatloads of money, you know, into rebuilding downtown to make it look, you know, as the downtown skyline looks today.
The business corridor for this new burgeoning Texas.
And who has to make the city safe? The police, right? And so there's that's the whole other thing that we should talk about. But I think that point, you know, and that's why, you know, the back to Pascal, your question about defunding, is it like, what do we make of it? Is that the slow, you know, I think it's gotten to this point where it's become this slogan that misses actually the real politics behind it. If you look at people, the activists who are really working on this stuff, is saying it's really about investing in communities in ways that meet people's needs, right? And so that's about housing, employment, healthcare, and all of those, and all of that. It's like, you know, the LAPD budget that they just passed is like $1.76 billion with a B. Mm. And so the question becomes like, you know, and Garcetti, the mayor of LA, just put, you know, this budget represents an increase in the police budget after last year when he said, we'll defund, we'll follow some of the demands of activists, and we'll, but now they're increasing the budget, and $1.8 billion almost is a lot of money when you then have people who are like, we need housing, we need jobs, you know, all the, it's like, well, you could do a lot with that money. And so that's, I think, where that slogan gets lost, right? To your point. And then even to say, you know, well, we just want mental health workers coming, I think is really instructive, Jason, to say, well, you've got to address the fundamental, you know, underlying need that people are, you know, experiencing, right? Especially if it's something around, you know, like with Eula Love, that the power company, and like, I have this problem, you know, and again, the power company representative calls the police, right? So, so I think those are all important. You know, we have to.
And, you know, we can go a little deeper in the weeds if you'd like to, and Pascal definitely chime in. And we've talked about this before on our friend. We do the Left Flank Vet show earlier in the day, and we definitely get into the weeds on this all the time. But there was an article that came out about a few months or so ago about the Bay Area. I don't know if you spent much time here, but we have our own like subway system called BART. Like, hey, we're going to have all these public health, or not public health, we're going to have the healthcare professionals that are going to answer mental health calls on public transportation, which is probably the majority of your calls on public transportation, because a lot of homeless people live on the train, right? So how does that look? And then who are these people? I think in the minds of the average citizen, they're thinking that they are going to get a psychologist. Probably not. You'll be lucky if you have someone that, and then people want to argue about, well, degrees are overrated. Like, sure. But it's usually a third party that handles this, and we live in a capitalist society. They're not looking for the best people for the job. They're looking for anyone that wants to take a job that probably nobody wants to take. And you're going to be severely overworked. You are not going to be getting paid the overtime like art police and regular police are paid overtime. There's a reason why they love these arrests. The paperwork, court appearances are overtime. That cop ain't missing your fucking ticket appointment, homie. That's time and a half. The bitches are going to be there every time. And they'll laugh at you. Man, it's time and a half. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be there for that time and a half.
Yeah.
Well, so go ahead.
No, I mean, I would say it's like these, all of this, this question that Pascal raised and that you're raising too, Jason, you know, these all bring up when we start to get into those weeds about, well, what if we did this reform or what if we moved, you know, those are all reforms that might disempower the police or take money away from them. Those are all reforms that move us in a direction, right? But I think partially what the earlier discussion about structure, right, and systems get us thinking about is that it really, once you start really thinking about it in these terms, right, well, are you just going to have a social worker acting as the policeman, or, you know, are you really going to, is it shows us that the whole structure of policing needs to actually perhaps be rethought, right? We have to actually, you know, this is revolution, right? Really rethink the entire structure.
I agree. We have to see a different vision. I agree.
And so that's where these conversations are so important, because it moves us, I think, when we really dig into all these things to say, hey, are we just going to, if we don't actually change the underlying structure of how the society works, are these reforms just then going to reproduce the system in a different guise, right?
Well, I think for me, if we have any kind of aspiration of ending capitalism and transforming this into a new society, we've got to change the ideological superstructure of everything we have in the society and escape ourselves from this capitalist realistic nightmare that we've had as a vision of normalcy in terms of what is functioning as the economy. We've got to, the whole ideological superstructure has to be completely transformed.
No, I'm with you 100% on that one, Pascal.
Yep.
100% on that one. And I think that's the problem, is that we're, the people that are talking the loudest are speaking in slogans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so frightening. We live in a hashtag culture. And first hashtag wins. You know, has to be
right. One. Yep.
You know, defund the police. I had Alex Vitale. I don't know if you follow any of his work.
Yeah, he's a, I know him. Yeah.
You said like y'all got gang beef.
Oh, no. He's a friend of mine. Like, I mean, I know him as a Scott, you know, or.
He was actually an early guest on the show. And even before, he was on the show before defund the police, right, really took off. And he had wrote a whole piece for the New York Daily News, I think, about, mm-hmm, if you just cut the NYPD budget in half, which was like, what, $6 billion or some stupid number like that, right? He was like, you can have all this money for the same thing you said, all these other programs. When you talk about LA and that police budget, when those teachers were striking last year, or it was a year before last, one thing they were striking for, which I found that no one really talked about, was the fact that teachers couldn't afford to live where they caught. That's kind of frightening. And the LA Times, I don't know if you know, I know you're no longer in the area, yeah, but they actually do
try to pay attention to what they're doing. Yeah.
they do some decent work on real estate in LA. And they had done a piece a few years ago. They had a series a few years ago on real estate in California. And there was a house in the Bay Area in Sunnyvale, which is kind of like the outskirts, or maybe you can call it Silicon Valley. And it's $820,000, I think, over asking price for a 3 and a 2, less than 2,000 square feet, regular single family home in Silicon Valley. It was an older home. This was not a new construction. $800,000+ over asking. It was the largest overbid in California history. What mailman can afford to live and deliver mail in that situation?
Or teachers,
yeah. And you know, and there's been several teacher strikes. You know, we had Los Angeles, of course, right. Oakland had a big teacher strike. Also saying the same thing. I can't afford to live in the area that I teach in. And if law enforcement's function is protecting property values, how then does law enforcement act for people that don't, quote unquote, belong in this now newly expensive area? That's just a regular sub. We're not talking about super fancy areas here. We're not talking about the Hollywood Hills,
right.
or Marin County. You know?
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's where the police, again, you know, are there. I mean, they see those, you know, this gets me to the kind of questions around gentrification and kind of how the police act there. And, right, you know, it becomes then the ways that the police then end up, you know, again, reproducing that, you know, back to Pascal, the ideological system that we have, right? That's another function they have, right? You know, that they are supporting that structure, you know, and I, you know, supporting that system of capital and private property and property rights. And so it's like, you know, what's it going to look like when they start, you know, when, and that, and you see that in cities, I think a lot, where it's like, well, you know, as cities redevelop and become gentrified, right, for the lack of a better term, and they become these great, you know, the downtown is now great and white middle class people like to go back there, right? But in part of that, it's because the police have made it safe for them to do so, right? Mm-hmm. Or in their mind, right? And so we have to, and this gets us again back to that bigger question about, like, what are the police doing, and what function do they serve in our society, right? And that's where the deeper questions about, like, yeah, some of the just changing the, you know, these kind of smaller, what we might call smaller reforms, right? Budgets or, you know, changing who gets called isn't going to change that, you know, and that's where we have to have this bigger vision, I think.
I'm with you. And we are coming up on an hour. And that means that we are going to end this show and we're going to head to the patron only bonus after hours segment. If you're not a patron, here's the link to become a patron. It's good times. If you guys don't know, I fucked around and figured out how to have calls. So we're going to be taking your calls. Don't worry. It's all friends and the bonus half, Max. We don't get crazy shit talkers. We took calls for the free show Saturday. It was actually a lot of fun. But again, it's me working the phone. I have a tendency to fuck up.
At least he's honest.
Yeah,
I am.
There you go.
I made you drop a call. I'm not hanging up on you on purpose. I'm just like an old person fiddling around with a digital camera in the early 2000s.
Max, I want to thank you for coming on our show today, man. I hope you had a good time. We definitely did. It was very informative. Your articles were excellent. Definitely, we got to get your book. And hopefully, as we work out the current moment in our history, dealing with this police crisis and situation and the politics around it, you'd be willing to come back again and add more nuance and historical foundation to what we're actually doing here in trying to make this a humane society when it comes to how, you know, the state's armed patrolmen deal with our population.
Right. Well, I mean, thank you for having me again. And thank you all for everyone who came and watched live. And for those of you who are listening later. And yeah, no, I'm, you know, these are conversations that we need to have. So I'm always happy to come back.
All right, you said nothing but a word. I got your motherfucking email now, Max.
You can blow me up or something, you know, with emails.
All right, thank you guys. And we are out.